one of them said, "Dirty scab," and spit at me. And I'm getting rather emotional now. I've never wanted to be a star, and certainly I've achieved that. I've never been a star or an artist.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Alan Bailey.
I was a little chubby kid in a secondary modern school. Just before that, we used to go and run into the air raid shelters because Adolf was flying his Messerschmitts over us, and whenever we heard the siren, we had to dash into the air raid shelters. Used to have, you'd call it a third of a pint in old language, of milk. We used to get free milk every day to have a bun from the co-op, which was opposite the school. My first interest was in films, because I can remember my mother in early years taking me to the local cinema, which I later worked in as a projectionist. And I remember seeing these colour films of aerial shots of our planes bombing places in Germany. I was more interested in the flicker of the lights coming from the projector than the film itself, because I was only a young kid. I wasn't really interested in watching war films or newsreels as they were then. And in later years, I became a cinema projectionist, and I was fascinated, about those flashing lights going through the hall of the cinema. Truth be said, most of them were in black and white. Most of my life was in black and white in those days. Oh, things like Humphrey Bogart, Alan Ladd, but I was absolutely fascinated by the cinema.
Driving?
Well, yes.
Take me with you. Oh, it isn't just the date. I've got to get out of this house tonight.
Why? What's the matter?
You know.
Then I had to do my national service, where Her Majesty very kindly called me up to do a service in the Royal Corps of Signals, which I had to learn Morse code and all sorts of bits and pieces like that. This was based in Germany, in a place called Gütersloh. And in the evenings, because I'm a non-drinker, I used to listen to radio stations like AFN.
This is the American Forces Network.
Luxembourg, BFN, British Forces Network. And I was really impressed with Luxembourg, because they got a very good signal out there.
The Lux Radio Theatre, great dramatic program with the stage and screen's most famous stars.
Radio Tonight Luxembourg star, was, I've got to say, an international station, although most people would say it's only a national station. It was transmitted from Luxembourg, but a lot of the programmes in those days were recorded in London. I used to hear people like Pete Murray.
The Applejacks with Tell Me When, the boys and girls who up until recently were students in Birmingham. Well, they've now made enough money to take over the school.
Keith Fordyce, Jack Jackson, never thinking that one day I would meet these luminaries and be absolutely impressed by them.
And there you have the Safaris with a little thing entitled Wipeout, which is what Alan Bailey will be done with very shortly if he does any more of that.
They were, quite honestly, the happiest moments of my life. I love them. And I thought, well, at the end of my 2 years, I've got to see if I can get a job. I'll see if I can get a job in sound in some way. So I contacted film studios, the BBC, all sorts of places, Luxy, and everyone said, no, sorry, can't use you. No, not interested. And with film studios, it was very much a closed shop union wise and unless you knew someone there was not a hope in hell's getting into there. I then had an unexpected letter come from Luxy saying that if I was interested, a vacancy has occurred, would I contact the chief engineer, which I duly did. After the interview, he said, okay, we'll let you know. Then I had a letter saying, yes, I can start with them. And that was the thrill of my life, because I've never wanted to be a star or an artist or anything like that. And certainly I've achieved that. I've never been a star or an artist. But it didn't matter, because I just wanted to deal with sound. I used to listen to programmes like War of the Worlds with Orson Welles.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them.
It was amazing to me how you conjure images in people's minds. And I was absolutely riveted by this. And also by Dick Barton, Special Agent, and Paul Temple. I just wanted to do this. And so my story of broadcasting began. Just a junior engineer learning how to gram operate. I mean, that may sound very simple, gram operating, but it's not as easy as it sounds, because there were things like to play a record, you had to turn the record back a quarter of a turn, and you had a fader that you had to keep down, and then when you open the fader, the music would start, and it didn't slur in, it came in at the right speed. But more importantly, in the days of comedy, I found that more useful, because you had to pick the records up from the vocal, stop the music from coming in, and just picking up where the singing starts. This came in very handy for things like Jack Jackson, with all the sketches that he had, Jack Jackson's Roundup.
RCA Victor, I'm presenting Hank Loughlin, telling us all about The Last Thing on My Mind.
To my son Sheldon, I bequeath, tax-free, $1 million.
Well, what can you expect with a love like yours?
Well, Jack Jackson was probably the most brilliant DJ of all time, if you exclude Kenny Everett. Because Jack Jackson, very funny man. In his early years, he was a very famous band leader, led a dance band. Someone had the bright idea, you know, that they should get him to introduce records. And him being very, very funny man, used to devise these little sketches with people. And it could be Benny Hill, Abbott and Costello, Malcolm and Wise, all characters like that, and incorporate them in a little sketch where he would say something to them and they would come back with something which was on a record, and we had to spin all those bits and pieces in. Another one we used to do was for Bob Monkhouse. He had a similar sort of thing where he was talking to people under the guise of DJ Jimmy Savile, call himself Jimmy Gabble, and ask these questions of pop singers about their life, and we would interject with all these little bits of vocal.
And this is your old chum, Jimmy Gabble, once again. And tonight, here at my pre-recorded party, we're going to give a fast hello and an even faster goodbye to the latest smash star, whose latest waxing is already 345 on the waiting list for the top 1,000.
They were recorded mostly, I started off in Studio A at Luxembourg, which was mainly the main music studio, and it had loads of big bands there. But later on, I went into Studio B, which was in Hertford Street, the famous number 38 Hertford Street, London West 1, where we get millions and millions of fan mail for the programmes. Used to spin the records in for people like Keith Fordyce, Pete Murray, Jack Jackson, Kent Walton.
In this big, white, colourful world,
there is music.
Let a little musical colour into your evening.
Colourful Radio Luxembourg.
The government wouldn't allow us to broadcast on behalf of the GPO, which is the General Post Office. We tried to do programmes live from the studios in London, and the GPO, as it was then, said, no, sorry, you're not allowed to. Because there was a ban on broadcasting in this country. I'd never really understood the sense of that. And so that's why we had studios in London to record the programmes, because we couldn't do anything else other than record the programmes there. And then they were flown out to Luxembourg in my day. I mean, in earlier days, they had to go by train across the continent and things like that. And so it would take about a week for programmes to get to Luxembourg. But this was before my time. We're talking about the 30s now. I only ever went out to Luxembourg once, and that was from the managing director's kind offer. He said, you've been here for quite a while now, Al. He said, you know, we'd like you to spend a few days out there, courtesy of the company. that I did. And I was married at the time, and my wife was pregnant with my eldest son, Scott. We had a tour around the area of Luxembourg, courtesy of Bob Stewart. He was a brilliant host. He took me to loads of places of interest. I got loads of photographs, went all around the Villa Lavigny, looking at the radio studios, because not only did they broadcast in English, they broadcast in German, Italian, all sorts of languages. So I used to see the studios that all these people worked in on other languages, and it was so, so impressive.
And this is where we welcome listeners in Western Germany who've just joined us for our programmes on UKW VHF, 97 megacycles per second. Good evening to you. This is Radio Luxembourg, broadcasting on 208 metres medium wave and 49.26 metres short wave. It's 9 o'clock and...
But the very first programme I recorded at Hertford Street was Italy Sings with Keith Fordyce, and I became very, very good friends over the years. He used to live in Amersham. I lived in Hemel Hempstead, and he used to invite me out to his lovely house. And the blizzard blew up, so but we spent the rest of the day. He sat at his grand piano. He had a baby grand piano in his house, and he sat there and played me all these amazing tunes. And I felt like royalty. I was really enjoying it.
Radio Luxembourg presents Star Gala, introduced by Keith Fordyce.
Yeah, so Italy Sings was the first program my gram operated on. I always remember, because when I got home, I said to my mum and dad, I said, oh, you've got to listen to this programme. I said, this is the first programme I've ever done. And the poor mum and dad, they had to sit there dead quiet and listen to this programme. It was only a quarter of an hour, to let them think that their son had played the records on this programme. And that's my earliest memory. Other than another Italian flavour was when I went for my interview at Radio Luxembourg. It was held in Studio B by the chief engineer, and there were a couple of engineers working on a broken tape recorder at the time. And what they were doing to try and correct this, they were playing a record on the turntable to see how it recorded afterwards. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. It was Volare by the Maguire Sisters. And whenever I hear that record now, it takes me straight back to my interview in 38 Hertford Street. That was in 1958. Things changed quite a lot in that period, because when I first started there, we were spinning in 78s, which was much more difficult, and the 45s had just started, and the 78s, and they were always getting smashed. A lot of times we used to have a wonderful session of getting these old 78s out the record library, which were no longer played, and they used to be skipped. And I remember getting myself pristine copies of Nelly Lutcher and Paul Robeson for my own personal collection. Bob Monkhouse and Dennis Goodman at that time had a programme called Smash Hits, where people write in for a pet hate record of theirs and to smash it. So we'd play the record, and then theoretically it would be smashed. And we used to be in Studio B, and we used to get these 78s and put them in between the lid of the Steinway grand piano and smash it down on top of them. Used to throw them up in the air, set them down on a board and throw teacups at them, thing like, just to get all these different smashes, so it wasn't the same smash all the time. 45s and 33 and a thirds were a form of plastic type record, and the 78s were what they called shellac, and so very, very brittle. You had to treat them very, very carefully. If you was going to get one out of a sleeve and put it over the turntable and hit maybe the pickup or something like that against it, it would smash. Then we'd have to go and get another duplicate copy from the library.
Look with your ears. Violet, indigo, green, yellow, orange, red.
Colorful Radio Luxembourg.
The saying of the day, pictures with sound, you know, because that's what we create in sound effects.
All the colours of the rainbow before your very ears.
With Kenny Everett, who was developing all sorts of sound effects. This is before he went to his own studio and knocked up his own programmes for Luxembourg. He used to have great times with Kenny Everett in the 60s, so I suppose it must have been the mid-60s, and that came about because as the pirate stations were closing down, or had closed down, Kenny was on Radio London, and Luxembourg employed him several times to come in and do programmes, which he did, and then he'd say something silly, and he'd get the sack, and then a few months later he'd be back again doing some more, and then he'd get the sack again, and it just kept on going like that.
The masterminds at Radio Buxom Girl, your station on the stairs, have come out with a plan that goes,
send a poem to...
Remember, Kenny is very, very skinny, and scatty is the word to describe it. And we had an old organ type thing there, a pedal organ. While you were playing it, you had to pump the foot pedals, the bellows. We made a theme tune for him on this program, and of course in later years sound effects, I did a hell of a lot for Monty Python group, because they came to me and asked me if I'd record their albums, and there's one famous one for those that do remember Monty Python albums. There's one with a blue snake wrapped around it called Monty Python's Previous Album. And then there was Matching Tie and Handkerchief. It was my body that I used for the sound effect when dear old Graham, bless his soul, said, and now a massage from the Swedish Prime Minister, and I did this. And I put up a couple of stereo mics, and I moved between left and right, so it sounded like someone smacking the body.
Now, a massage from the Swedish Prime Minister.
I've got £90,000 in my pyjamas.
I was also the chemist where someone went in to ask for something for the weekend, and they were attacked by a herd of zebras, and I had to shout out, Christ! And in a fairy tale sketch, I was the prince falling from the tower. Making lots of personal sound effects like that. Some we used library sound effects, but in those days, there weren't too many sound effects around. I suppose most of them were supplied by the BBC from their library. But in later years, there were loads and loads of companies, American and English, that started libraries of sound effects, and you could get anything you wanted without having to record it. The Luxembourg gong was a real gong. That wasn't a sound effect. There was a little button on the desk in Luxembourg, and you press the button, and that gong was connected through wires to another part of the building where there was actually a little gong. Goes bong. But in the early years, in the 30s, they had another gong. It was more like a miniature J. Arthur Rank type gong. Very harsh. So the gong has changed quite a lot over the years.
Well, it's just 2 minutes after 11:30, and yes, you guessed it first time. That means Sunday night request time at Luxembourg.
It was about 1974, that I realised the writing was on the wall for Radio Luxembourg, although they didn't really want to admit it. All the DJs were out in Luxembourg live. The Luxembourg studios were mainly down to me recording albums for people like Rediffusion, Studio 2, and all sorts of things like that, with orchestras and bands. I thought, well, I've got to move on. And round about this time, I was contacted and said, look, we're setting up a radio station in Nottingham. We'd like you very much to run the commercial production of it, but not just commercial production, production of documentaries and all sorts of things like that. And that appealed to me very much. I had an interview with them, the chairman at the time. It didn't sound quite right to me. And I thought, well, no, thank you for the offer, but I don't feel it's for me. And they said, well, don't close the door. You know, we'll come back to you on it. It wasn't just finance. It was the description, the job description and everything like that. And so they did come back to me. And then I said, well, OK, fine. Then I moved up to Nottingham and helped set up Radio Trent.
This is a test transmission from the Independent Broadcasting Authority. From transmitters at Trowell and Colwick Wood, we're broadcasting on 301 metres medium wave, that's 998 kilohertz, and on 96.2 megahertz VHF. The VHF transmission...
Well, the job I was eventually offered was a production and studio manager, which meant overseeing all the commercials that were made, setting up a department with scriptwriters, or copywriters, as they're called, to try and make award-winning commercials, of which I'm proud to say I picked up quite a few along the journey. I've had a lot of experience in making ads. I've got to mention my son Scott here, because while I was at Radio Luxembourg, I was making commercials, and strangely enough, I applied to Capital Radio quite a while before all this. I got a beautiful handwritten letter from Richard Attenborough, Sir Richard Attenborough, as he became, saying, no, you know, we study carefully the sort of people that we want, and unfortunately we can't offer you the position. Strangely enough, I ended up doing a hell of a lot of commercials for Capital Radio in their early days at Luxembourg, and I was just mentioned to my son Scott, because when he was about 3 months old, this particular commercial for Endosil cream for rubbing on babies' bottoms and things like that, they wanted a sound effect of a baby sort of gurgling and then crying and then giggling or something like that. And so then we recorded this commercial for Endosil, which was one of the first commercials ever on Capital Radio.
When you were a baby, you had a soft, moist skin. But as you grew up, central heating,
so
makeup... So
that was his first ever broadcast of about 3 months old.
And as an introductory offer, you can buy Endosil moisturisers and beauty cream for 48 pence.
So I had quite a lot of experience doing commercials, because we're also doing commercials for Radio London, Radio Caroline, because we could do commercials for them where they were greatly inhibited, because they were sort of banned from the shores of Great Britain, and they had to get their commercials in and where they could.
You can get for your want in your car. Got to tune into the station. Got to tune into the station.
My first memory of coming into Nottingham, it was Easter, just before our July opening of Radio Trent, and there was a terrible blizzard, and everything looked yellow and black and horrible. And I was travelling up with John Peters at the time, and John went on to be our top jock at Trent. Brilliant, brilliant DJ. I wish he was in the business today. He is so talented and so clever. Anyway, we come in on the train into Nottingham Station, terrible blizzard, and I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I was really upset and thought I'd made a terrible mistake, because it all looked so filthy and dirty. But that was the snow, and, you know, it was a very grey day. As came close to opening time, Easter, you know, the sun started coming out, and I suddenly realised what a beautiful city Nottingham was.
You've laughed with Radio Amazon. You've cried with Radio Ganges. Now, Whittam with Radio Trent, Britain's only freshwater radio station.
Prior to this, at Radio Luxembourg, I'd done some interviews with Telly Savalas, Johnny Mathis, and a couple of others I can't remember now, saying words to the effect of, we're very pleased to be speaking for the very first time on Radio Trent, a brand new station in Nottingham, and we wish you all the success for the future. And I went up to the programme controller at the time and I said, I don't know if you want to use these. I said there were greetings from Telly Savalas, Johnny Matheson and a few others. He said, oh, thank you very much, and threw them in the waste bin. And I thought, oh, we're going to get on great. And I could never understand why a programme director would want to throw those in the bin instead of using him. Such big names like that, opening a radio station on the first day and even the first week. I never understood them.
We've got the sounds of this town. Spread it around, sweet music. Trench is the place, 301 is the space.
Well, when I first walked into Radio Trent, it was a very impressive building because it looked like some ancient courthouse, very grand stonework. And then I learnt that the production studio that I was working in was a ladies' mortuary, which didn't bode well. A lot of people claimed in their time to have seen ghosts there. The studios were very well equipped, all designed by Sandy Brown Associates, who set up all the planning for the studios because they had a wonderful record of setting up broadcasting studios. And our chief engineer at that time was Jeff Woodward, who is a very fine engineer and who I'd worked with previously indirectly at Radio Luxembourg. He said to me, what sort of equipment do you want? So I said, well, we've definitely got to have Neumann microphones because without doubt, they are the world's best. And because we both had previous dealings with Rupert Neave, we had Neave desks installed in the broadcast studio, in the news booths and everything. Everything was done out with Neave. And the sound we got was, you know, absolutely amazing. The tapes that we used initially were quarter-inch tapes. Some of the decks that we used were Revox, more basic Revoxes. But then we had a multi-track machine, which I'm trying to remember whether it was 1-inch wide or 2-inch wide, which allowed us to record on quite a few tracks so that we could overdub instruments. And when we did jingles for local advertisers, we had things like guitars, which were overdubbed, piano overdubbed, singers overdubbed. Sometimes there were about three or four singers and ended up by being about 12 singers. Every year we used to have a live programme, actually broadcast live from my studio, of Christmas carols, where we had a group come in, and I can remember the name of them to this day, the Eminon Singers. They weren't professional singers, they were mums and dads, solicitors, shop owners and that. And of course this is where my experience come in handy, because I used to put the reverb on, but then I used to delay the reverb by delaying it again so it sound like Westminster Abbey. The first commercials we recorded in Nottingham, I was really upset about it because I realised that a lot of them were not going to be heard by the public, because what we used to do was make demonstration commercials so that our sales team could go out and sell them to shopkeepers, different trades and things like that, extolling the virtues of their product. Once the airtime started coming in, it started coming in fast and furious, and we were making great money in those early days.
Billy Paul, July, July, July. I'll go along with that. Good morning, sleepyheads. How are you this morning? Weather today, continuing mainly dry, sunny periods, becoming warm this afternoon.
The very first ad the very first ad that went out was for Scan, which was in the Victoria Centre in Nottingham. It was like a Tesco's, I suppose you could put it today. And our programme director at that time, he read it. It was in the form of a poem, extolling the virtues of Scan.
Down in the jungle, there the message.
But then we had things like Cameo cameras. Sometimes we were always getting into trouble with the Independent Broadcasting Authority because they thought it was a bit too questionable, some of the things we wanted to do with Cameo cameras. We had a very lecherous broadcaster not a real live broadcaster, but a pseudo broadcaster, who was rather like, very much a Les Dawson type character, like, ooh, ambitious, where'd you get that from? Or things like that.
Fire! And he's done it! He's landed in the porridge feet first, followed by his head, and then his left arm.
We have the prices, we give the service, you get the picture and Cameo.
A line that I particularly liked, and I knew it was sick, but I'd see if I could get it past the Independent Broadcasting Authority, was Four Pork Farms saying, little piggies everywhere are dying to get into our pork pies. But we all had sort of cynical, silly senses of humour there, and we all play off one another to see how silly we could be.
Don't miss the Nottingham Observer.
Two.
Don't miss the Nottingham Observer.
Three.
Don't miss the Nottingham Observer. I don't believe that.
Four.
Well, it wasn't.
I bet you.
I don't know what it is.
Five.
Did I say
the anything? Best personality voiceover we're going to do a commercial, I've got to say, is Gordon Jackson, the late Gordon Jackson. Gordon Jackson was a great big TV star at the time. That's why we use them, along with people like Frankie Howard, who were big TV stars. They did commercials too. Gordon Jackson was in a TV series called The Professionals, which was a crime series, and he played the governor against Bodie and Doyle. But prior to that, he was also the butler in Upstairs, Downstairs.
We must all of us learn to trust
our fellow men, perhaps, sir, but not all the women. That new parlourmaid, for instance, I wouldn't trust her as far as a flick of her feather duster.
What a true gentleman he was. He came in and did some commercials for us, main ones being Pork Farms. And so one of our copywriters, Ted, he wrote a spoof Pork Farms one, where he's having a go at Pork Farms. I mean, it was never used. There's no way it could be used.
You know, all it takes is one bite of a Pork Farms beefsteak pie to remind me of the good old days. All those gristly lumps of soya meat swimming in a sickly monosodium.
Gordon Jackson was a really lovely man, and I used to sit down for ages and talk to him about when he was making a film once. I think it was called The Foreman Went to France. And he had great laugh telling us about how he couldn't drive at the time. And he had to drive one of these desert rat type vehicles, and he couldn't drive. And so the team on the film, they had to push him, and he had to look like he was driving. And he had loads of stories like that.
Hi, Superthorn here. To make way for container loads of winter stock arriving shortly that will bring you special deals on Superthorn batteries this weekend, starting Friday night.
Sometimes the advertisers wanted to voice their own commercials, and most of them were not very good at it. We had one guy in one day who was advertising a shop in Hockley. And he had one of those unfortunate dispositions where he couldn't say his R's, and it's sort of like, come around to our place now, we've got a wonderful selection, you know. I had to have the unenviable task of saying to him, look, I'm sorry, we can't use you, you know. He insisted, and I said, well, can we come to a compromise? We'll get you to say a couple of lines of a commercial and then get an announcer to do the rest of it. So he settled on that, so that commercial went out like that. But there were other advertisers, a famous window double glazing company that did their own commercials, but they were a totally different class, and there was a very good jingle company that did the jingles for them. In the end, they thought the jingle company was so good they bought the jingle company. But they were very, very successful, but not only on Radio Trent, on other independent local radio stations around the country.
Oh, Mum, call, say you'll call a Mum call today. Our windows are old and they don't fit right. Oh, he's cold and Teddy's got frostbite. Mum, call, say you'll call a Mum call today. That's a free spot.
Very often we didn't get much of an idea of feedback of how the commercials are doing, except that if there was an exceptional campaign that went well, the sales team, whoever was in charge of that particular client, would come down and say, oh, thanks, the client absolutely loves it, because obviously the commercials, they have to go out and be played to the client for him to approve before it goes out on air. And more often than not, they all came back and said, oh yeah, we like that very much. And one very embarrassing thing for me one day, we was advertising a lager, I think it was Target, I'm not sure, where a group of people came round and I was explaining to them and played a couple of excerpts from the commercials that we had done for them that was lined up to go out on broadcast. And I said, you know, the boss of this company is very, very happy with what we do. And this lady popped up and says, oh, I'm the wife of that gentleman. And yes, we must say that they were very, very good. And I thought, how lucky is that?
Representative example deposit 990, then 48 monthly payments of 159. Dealer contribution 1500. Cash price 13195. Credit 10705. Finance fee 99. Final payment 5157. Total payable 1533.
Occasionally we get an advertiser that wants to throw everything into his advertising. We're the cheapest, we're the biggest, we're the best, we do this, we can guarantee our prices are cheaper than anyone else's. And a lot of the regulations from the Independent Broadcasting Authority wouldn't allow them to say that they're the biggest or the best. It has to be quantified legally in some form or other. There was one particular client, he was a particular fan of the Vietnam War. Everything we had to write was built around the Vietnam War, with helicopters going above, shooting and gunning and things like that. But he just wanted to create the atmosphere of a war zone based on Vietnam. I'll never understand that, and as far as I know, it didn't really work, because he was only appealing to a very small section of the audience. And it's the same as with other advertisers. Ladies, do you feel that so-and-so... straighten, well, you're alienating the male sense of the audience. Or men, do you have so-and-so? It's got to be quite general so that you pull in everyone as an interest for that advertisement.
And now I'd like to meet the lady who plans the meals in your home. Ah, there you are. Good morning. May I ask you a question? You often give the family a jelly for their sweet, don't you? And it makes a very attractive sweet. Quickly made, too. Not that the
well,
family
in the
think
60s,
of that.
Oh, commercials no. Are all very much the same. Like I was talking about, ladies, gentlemen, they all started off like those. Because advertising in the 60s, whether it be television or radio, was very, very new to this country. It had been running in America for years and years and years, and they would dab hands at it. But we still had these very Oxford-educated accent saying, if you would like to get so-and-so, then why not go to so-and-so? And it was all terrible rubbish like that. I mean, we didn't realise it was terrible rubbish at the time, but as the years went by, we realised how much rubbish it was. But we had some wonderful people in advertising agencies that... this might interest you. There was Bose Massimi and Pollitt, an excellent advertising agency, and a guy there called John Webster, and he wrote some wonderful commercials. And I did a lot of commercials with them, and to show you how much adverts had changed, I did the Cadbury Smash Martians TV soundtrack.
On your last trip, did you discover what the Earth people eat? They eat a great many of these. They peel them with their metal knives.
I did the Cresta Bear TV soundtrack. I did the PG Tips Chimps soundtracks. And there's another one. Oh, the Honey Monster.
Tell them about the honey, mummy.
I did all these. And of course, that's... shows you how much adverts have changed over the years. And I must say, to give myself a pat on the back, since no one else will do it, is that Channel 4, quite a few years ago, they run a programme that was the best 100 TV commercials ever, and mine were in the first four positions of those ones that I just mentioned.
Trent 301.
When Radio Trent first started, there were two people applying for the franchise of it, and one was Radio Trent Limited, and the other one was Radio Robin Hood. Radio Robin Hood was the Nottingham Evening Post. They didn't get the franchise and Radio Trent did, so there was a lot of rivalry between the two, and a very silly situation occurred whereby the Nottingham Evening Post wouldn't even mention Radio Trent in their papers, not even programmes that were coming up. So Radio Trent, in its stupidity, played this game and said, oh, well, we won't mention the Nottingham Evening Post. We'll just call it your local evening paper. I cannot believe these things actually happened, but they did. And eventually we became sort of friends, and they started advertising with us, and we started advertising with them. It shows you how stupid life can be. And we did an advert for them for the Evening Post for their classifieds, and Malcolm Mortimer, who was one of our top copywriters at the time, wrote this wonderful one involving Richard Briers and Penelope Wilton, and it was all about trying to sell an elephant to the public. The idea was, think in terms of elephant's legs. Elephant has four legs, so it's four. Double elephant has eight legs. Half an elephant has two legs. So Richard Briers had to go, 482, 482. And people in Nottingham, still to this day, can quote that number. It was tremendously successful. In fact, it went on to win quite a few awards. I'm sitting here in my lounge now, and I've got certificates for all the awards that we won for Elephant Classified.
482, 482. Remember, 482, 482, love.
I'll just tie a knot in my trunk, shall I?
Oh, don't be silly, love. Think of it in terms of elephant's legs. Four legs, that's elephant. Eight legs is double elephant, and two legs is half an elephant. 482, 482.
Probably the most upsetting days I had at Radio Trent was when we had a strike, because the company wanted to get rid of the programme director. The programme director had many friends there in the terms of DJs, because they had all worked together previously, and they supported the programme director.
There is some personal animosity between me and the managing director. I was hired by the board of this company, not by Dennis Malin.
So it was a very uneasy situation. I mean, I remember when the DJs were out on the doorstep forming a picket line, and I went out one evening because I was carrying on working. I wasn't a member of the union or anything like that. And one of them said, "Dirty scab," and spit at me. It didn't really hurt me, because I thought these DJs were much younger than I was, and I thought, well, they're just kids, you know, they've taken it all very personally. I don't take it personally at all, so it didn't bother me, although I still remember it, because it was not a very nice situation.
Radio Trent 301.
After the strike, there was quite a change in the company, which meant there was a new MD come into it. And I heard a rumour, someone come and said to me, "I've just had a talk with a new MD. And I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "That Alan Bailey downstairs, what does he do?" And I felt very, very edgy about that, because I thought, hello, I'm next on the cards to go. And I thought, how can a new MD come into the job and not be aware of the staff that were there and what their function was? My job, I thought, was on the line. But luckily enough, I stayed the course and stayed there until I chose to retire early in 1999.
How are you, Maggie? What do you call a woman with a parrot on her head?
Polly.
As the radio station and the organisation got larger and larger, and gobbling up other radio stations, we also found ourselves doing commercials for those stations too. I suppose one of the biggest problems were local pronunciations, like in Nottingham, is it Southwell, is it Southall? Likewise, these other stations had their problems, and very often the copywriters out in those regions, they didn't understand that we didn't know the pronunciations of some of these. So a lot of them we had to re-record, and then we were taken over yet again. We got some copywriters from up and down in Southampton way. And that same thing reared its ugly head again. Alan Bailey, what does he do? And then they put one of these people as head of commercial production, which effectively made me just an engineer recording the commercials. I didn't enjoy those times. After the strike, I never really enjoyed my time at Radio Trent because I was left with sort of lots of bad memories. Every year, all the voiceovers for radio and television and documentaries and things like that, they have a big party, a meal and a dinner and dance and that, and it's called Vox, V-O-X. Unbeknown to me, Phil Danks, who was part of the Trent setup, became part of the Capital setup, and he's now part of the Capital setup, and he organised with Peter Dixon, who is the voiceover on The X Factor.
Faux shizzle my nizzle!
And they organised a celebration for me for being 40 years in the business. I remember Peter Dixon standing up on stage. This guy has been in the business for 40 years. And I thought, oh, I've been in the business 40 years because I didn't know anything about it. And then he said, oh, and he's done this and he's done that. And I think, God, how come I don't know this bloke? You know, I've never met him and that. And then they said, the governor, Alan Bailey, resounding applause from all the people there. I don't know how many were in on it. There were lots of vocal contributions from people like Mike Palin, The Pythons, Fluff Freeman.
Well, now, what is all this I hear? You celebrating a whole 40 years in the business? Is it true the whole town's talking about the Bailey boy? To quote Victor Meldrew, I don't believe it. Anyway, they really should be talking about me, that's for sure. Anyway, Earl, this time around, we're all only too happy to be talking about you. And on 40 years, congratulations. Remember those far-off days at 208? They were really happy, right? Oh, bet your life. We're both still at it, kiddo, and although I hope I never get as old as you, working with you over the years has been just one great privilege, not half. Enjoy the celebrations, young Alan Bailey. We salute you, right?
That made me so very, very proud.
Furthermore, we love you. Right? Now bugger off.
He preceded me at Radio Luxembourg by about 1 year. He came over from Australia and he lived in the Melbourne Docks area. And God, that was a lasting friendship, that was, until his sad demise. I used to do all his programmes at Luxembourg. When I say I did his programmes, I span the records in, because the disc jockeys there had them spun in for them by the likes of me and people like me. And we got on so well, and when I lived in Hemel Hempstead with my parents, he used to come over, and I had my own little studio at home, and we'd set it up and we'd do a sort of a pick of the pops where I would do his announcements and rundowns, and he would spin the records in and do this and that. Wonderful times together. So much so, when I got married in 1972, he was the best man at my wedding, and I've got a wonderful photograph of us together there. After the wedding, we had a reception, and he gave a speech, and I don't think I've ever heard such a wonderful wedding speech in my life. It was all off the cuff, nothing written. And he was wonderful. He had the people there in stitches. In fact, the people that are still around now still talk about those days with great affection. He had us crying with laughter. He was absolutely brilliant. And I had to return the favour in like by him. When he died, I went to his funeral service, and there were all the big jocks of Radio 1 and Radio 2, all the people there. I took that very badly because we were just such wonderful mates. He used to record little messages for my mum and dad, because being best man at my wedding, he met my mum and dad, and he used to record little messages with his sort of sign of the swinging cymbal. Dun, 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 dun. Hi, mum. Hi, dad. You'll never guess we got on the menu tonight. very, very silly, but wonderful, wonderful times.
Redford's sale of blankets. Buy a second single at £1.29 and save £2.30.
Back in 2006, I wrote about my Luxembourg experiences in a book, and it sold very, very well. And then when it ran out, people kept on saying, are you going to have a reprint? And I said, well, no, for several reasons. It's got the mark of the devil on it. And the biggest part was with Jimmy Savile, because I put quite a lot of stuff in there about Jimmy Savile, along with photographs that I'd taken, because of all the trouble there was. I felt that it would be so wrong to put another edition of the book out, because if I took a lot of the Jimmy Savile bits out, there wouldn't be anything else. I mean, I personally got on ever so well with Jimmy Savile. I did his audition, and we got on ever so well, and I used to go out with Jimmy sometimes, and we'd go to places like Walthamstow Bars, because Jimmy was a professional wrestler, among other things, and he used to have these wrestling matches, so I used to go with him to see these. When he was voted, I think it was 3 years running as Britain's top jock, held at the post office tower, the reception, he invited me and my fellow engineer Colin to those receptions and went around introducing us personally to all the big stars like Dusty Springfield and all the others. So he held me, obviously, in great esteem. I was so upset when I heard these things. I mean, I have terrible trouble with my friends if we ever raise the subject of Jimmy Savile, because I don't believe a lot of what was said. People might think I'm very naive. In fact, a lot of my own family think I'm naive about that. The way I see it is, he died before he could ever be taken into the law courts. On my mobile phone, I've still got pictures of him, and I will not erase them, because I hold him in fond regard. Mind you, if he did the things that he was claiming, then I'd say, yeah, you know, hang him, you know, do whatever.
Hi there, guys and girls. Welcome to the TTDC. It's 10 o'clock on Wednesday night, and all 10 and 20 Disc Club members will be here.
It's got to be the biggest thing in my career is the Submariner, James Fallthorpe. He was a prisoner of war in Germany, and they were going round the Straits of Messina, and an Italian warship depth charged him, and they had to come out. As they were coming out and rising to the surface, there were German planes and Italian planes, and they were machine gunning him in the water and things like that. But luckily enough, he survived, and as I say, he was taken prisoner of war. Going back to the very, very early days of Luxembourg, I found all these 16-inch transcription discs with the Nazi swastika on symbols on, and I was just listening through to them, and most of them were in German, Bitte schneiden, and he talks, he does this interview with this British collaborator, because who had impeccably perfect BBC voice, asking him, and he says, what's your name? And he says, James Fallthorpe. And he says, and you come from Loo in Cornwall? And he gave the address. And he says, anything you'd like to say? And he said, I'd just like to say hello to my little son, Carlton. He's 4.5 years old. And I thought, oh, God, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could find this Carlton Fallthorpe and give a recording to his of his dad. And I searched for years and years and years on, and I found him. And I cannot tell you the thrill that I got when I found out. And I sent the letter to him saying, if you're the Carlton Fallthorpe that had a father who was a Submariner and was depth charged in the Straits of Messina, please write to this address or phone, because I've got something very important to tell you. Carlton got back to me, so I sent him the recording of his dad, and he was so pleased and thankful. I donated the record itself to the Submarine Museum in Gosport, Hampshire, for their files. And I'm getting rather emotional now. And I got a wonderful letter from Carlton's daughter saying, "Dear Alan, thank you so much for the... Dear Alan, thank you so much for allowing me to hear my granddad's voice, and I hope that one day that we can meet so I can thank you personally." And I thought, that was wonderful. I still got the letter to this day. And he survived the war. He didn't get a bullet in his head. And after all that time, I was able to put flesh and blood onto the bones of these ghosts that I had of Carlton and James Forethought. Wonderful experience. That was the highlight of my life, bar none. I think the favourite spell in terms of work from my whole career has got to be with Radio Luxembourg, as everything about my life. I mean, I ate, drank, breathed, slept Radio Luxembourg. And even this day, I still have wonderful memories of Radio Luxembourg. It was still the best years of my life. In fact, a few weeks ago, I got an invitation from the Luxembourg embassy, from the ambassador there, to attend an evening celebration of Radio Luxembourg and a particular DJ that had just had his book published.
We could go on all night, but we got the British service right now. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the English-speaking service.
My whole life, my whole thoughts on broadcasting really revolve around Radio Luxembourg. People often say to me, well, one particular individual says, "How would you like to be remembered?" I would just like to be remembered. I mean, I would be remembered by my family, of course, who I love very dearly, and some of the good friends I've made in the industry over the years. I can't think of how I'd like to be remembered. I suppose with a lot of the albums, I've probably got about a couple of dozen albums that I've made over the years, and my name would be on those. But, you know, as time goes by, they get very ancient and forgotten. And I know in my own life, being sensible about it, that I'm not going to be remembered except by an exceptional few, as I say, like my family.
Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch with their new single called Save Me. And by the way, they've just got their second LP out. It's called Music Be the Food of Love. And now over to you, sir.
I would just like to be remembered and to leave it at that.